When you think of a Methodist, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Maybe when you're teasing out the thought of a Methodist, you start thinking of some personalities. The name I was alluding to just a moment ago, the most famous Methodist of all time, perhaps you're famous with the great John Wesley, or his hymn-writing brother, Charles Wesley. Or maybe you're thinking of another hymn writer like Fanny Crosby. Did you know she was a Methodist? Or maybe you're familiar with some great politicians. There are a great many politicians. By my count, there are 5 U.S. presidents that were Methodists, the most recent of which was George W. Bush and his vice president, Dick Cheney. Or maybe you're familiar with even the 2016 candidate, Hillary Clinton, who has historically associated herself with the Methodist Church. It's even been a part of her most recent campaign. Or maybe you're familiar with the name Nelson Mandela, who associated with that particular denomination. You think of some people. You may have been surprised that there are even some Hollywood personalities that are associated with the Methodist Church. I was shocked to see that Beyonce evidently is associated with the Methodist Church. Didn't know that one. Or maybe you're familiar with names like Rush Limbaugh, or the guy who wrote all the Star Wars movies, George Lucas, associated with Methodism. Or maybe you're familiar with some great institutions that have the name Methodist affixed to it. Did you know that there are a great many Methodist universities in the United States, and some of them you probably had no clue were connected with the Methodist Church? Do you want to know what the most famous university in all the United States originally associated with the Methodist Church is? The great Duke University has as its origin Methodism. Or perhaps you're familiar with Emory University. Probably the most famous Methodist university today would be Southern Methodist University in the great Dallas-Fort Worth area. George W. Bush's presidential library is on the campus of that university. Anybody familiar with Boston University has a backstory with the Methodist Church. Or Wofford College, our pastor Clint Presley went to that school. It's a Methodist institution. Probably the most famous seminary, training school for pastors associated with the Methodist Church, is Asbury Seminary. You may be familiar with Asbury because their undergrad wing, the university, it is where that famed revival took place last year in February or so of 2023. Maybe your mind goes to some of those places. Or at the most vaguest sense, when you think of a Methodist, there's just, you know what, I heard that some of those hymns that I know and love, they were written by a Methodist. Did you know Charles Wesley, he wrote the famed Hark the Herald Angels Sing. That's a Methodist hymn, Christmas Carol. Or the famed Christ the Lord is Risen Today, that famous song that we sing almost every Easter Sunday, written by a Methodist, Charles Wesley. What comes to your mind when you think of him? Tonight, what I'm going to try to do is try to fill in those gaps so that after tonight, when you think about a Methodist, you'll have a more well-rounded view and understand how they compare and contrast with we, and I'm just assuming the vast majority of us gathered here tonight would be convictionally Baptist. We're going to see how they compare and contrast with we Baptists. So we're going to pursue the same course of study we have with the previous denominations. Let's first out ask where they came from. Who are these folks? What's their backstory? We'll tease out their history. Then I'm going to look at 2 final questions. One is broadly what they believe. Now, truth be told, most of what they believe is what we believe. They are thoroughly evangelical, although there are some groups that have become not so much. So I'm going to just point out some very specific things relative to the Methodist Church, not suggesting that's the sum total of what they believe. And then the last thing, which will be, I think, of most interest, is what are those distinctives? What would distinguish the average Methodist from it, for example, the average Baptist? We're going to look at some of those key theological distinctives in conclusion. So let's begin at the beginning. Where on earth did these Methodists come from? Well, I want you to see from the outset that the Methodists find their origination not in the United States, but in England. Anybody remember with me? I've now addressed this the last 2 weeks. When the Protestant Reformation started in Germany with Martin Luther, it spread all over Europe, including over into Great Britain. But there was a king in Great Britain in the early 1500s, King Henry VIII, who got sideways with the Pope. Y'all remember why? He had a wife that wasn't giving him kids. He decided he wanted to trade her in for a different model, and the Pope wouldn't let him do it. The Pope said, "You're not allowed to divorce." And he decided, you know what? Nobody tells the king what to do, even the Pope. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. So he booted the Pope and the Catholic Church essentially out of England and decided he's going to set up his own church. And it's creatively titled the Church of England. And he became the leader of it, which to this very day, the reigning monarch of England is the head of the Church of England. Queen Elizabeth II famously was. Her son, the current reigning monarch, Charles III, less famously so. By most accounts, he's not even a theist. He's not really a believer, but he is at least the titular head of the Church of England as it stands. Now, the Church of England, it was essentially a reformed church. It had decided it was going to be different from the Catholic Church, but it proved to be kind of like Diet Coke. It was just like Diet Catholicism. It really was Catholic Church with just a few little tweaks. So there was a group within the Church of England that decided, we got to fix this. We got to purify it. What was the name of that group that wanted to purify the purified Church of England? The Puritans. That's where we got their ingenious name. Those Puritans said, we got to fix this. We don't want just Diet Coke. We need to trade this for something much healthier. Let's get a healthier church. So the Puritans started fixing things. And eventually, a lot of them split off. And remember the names of the two big groups? Well, really, there's three, but I haven't taught you the third group. Three big groups split off from the Church of England because they thought it needed to be fixed. The Baptists, the Presbyterians, and then there's a third group called the Congregationalists, which are far less common today, but they were big time in the early colonial America. But there was one group that formed from within the Church of England. There were two ministers who were Church of England priests, or curates is what they called themselves. And these men went by the name John and Charles Wesley. They were brothers. John was the 14th of 19 children. Charles was, I believe, the 18th of 19 children. His mom and dad, they had a lot of kids, and they were raised in a most austere home. They were raised in the fear of the Lord. They had a home that was such that they had this weird combination of being Anglican, which is another word for being of the Church of England, Anglophile, Anglo, the English people, Anglican Church. They were Anglican, but they also had these kind of reformed Puritan strains within them. So they wanted to be a part of the church, but then they also wanted to purify it. Evidently, the dad, those boys' dad, he was more Anglo. He was more for the Church of England. Mama had some, her name was Susanna, she had some rebellious streaks. In fact, evidently, it's reported in some sources that the mother, Susanna, she was one who was, let's just say, against the king. She didn't even want to pray for the king, and her husband rebuked her for not praying for the king, and evidently they made up, and the product of them making up was their son John, and that is reported in a lot of history books, which is kind of wild to think about. Poor guy, it's written to this very day. So you have John and Charles Wesley, who go to college, like pretty much anybody would of their day, and they go to the most famed college of the great university we know as Oxford. By the way, Oxford is the first university in the world. It was the first place where they began to gather and study ancient texts at this Oxford, this place where the oxes would ford the river. There they started to study, and it became the famed institution we know to this day. It composed of several colleges, and the most famous college has a confusing name. Its most famous college to this very day, by the way, if you've ever watched Harry Potter, all those visuals of Hogwarts, that is this college. It's inside this college, and it's called Christ Church, which sounds like a church, right? It's really confusing, but Christ Church is the name of one of the colleges of Oxford. John and Charles Wesley go to Christ Church, a college of Oxford, and there they started meeting together, and they began to form a little club. They formed this small group because they really wanted to take seriously the holiness of God. They wanted their life to reflect their testimony, the noble. They wanted to be men of holiness. So they began to meet together, and they met at length. They would meet every day from 6 to 9 a.m., and in this little holy huddle, they would read the Greek New Testament. They would pray several minutes every hour of the day. They took communion every Sunday, which at that time the Church of England was only taking it a few times a year. They wanted to take it every Sunday. They would fast every Wednesday and Friday until 3 p.m. They even evangelized the local jail nearby. This group was really taking accountability and holiness seriously. It was a small group of 5-7 men. John and Charles, the only other famous name that you might be familiar with in this little holy huddle was George Whitefield. You ever heard the name George Whitefield? Famous individual in church history. This group started to be mockingly called the Holy Club. And you can go Google it. The Holy Club is a name that persists to this day. The Holy Club was this group formed by John and Charles Wesley, these men that really wanted to take holiness seriously. They became known not as the Holy Club. They became known by another pejorative term. And they were called the Methodists because they began to be renowned, or you might say infamous, in Christ Church College. They became infamous for their method of holy living. They were these guys that were obsessed with a method. In fact, there was a little ditty that was written that was often sing-song shouted at them to mock them. It went something like this. By rule they eat, by rule they drink, by rule do all things but think. Accuse the priests of loose behavior to get more in the layman's favor. Method alone must guide them all, when themselves Methodists they call. It was this weird little ditty that was basically saying these guys are just obsessed with their little method and they think they are doing everything better than everybody else. They became known as the Methodists. Well, John and Charles, they were taking their ministry and their holiness so seriously that they decided they needed to leave Great Britain and they needed to go to the New World where they would evangelize the natives, the American Indians. So they got on a boat. And in 1735, they immigrated to Savannah, Georgia, which to this day, if any of y'all ever been to Savannah, Georgia, you will find monuments and different artifacts commemorating John and Charles Wesley, not to mention George Whitefield's ministry that began in this famed city. While in Savannah, Georgia, they met a group of Christians. You may have heard them before. I taught you about them when we went through church history many moons ago. There's a group of Christians that took holiness as seriously as these so-called Methodists. This group was called the Moravians. And the Moravians, they really took their piety seriously. And John and Charles Wesley got a taste of it. You want to know what they first tasted? While on the boat, sailing across the ocean blue. Which, by the way, can you imagine having to have gone on one of those transatlantic voyages a couple hundred years ago? No lifeboats. The boat's all wood, storms, no radar, so you're just kind of like coming into these storms like this. Well, evidently, while on this journey, a horrible storm came upon their boat and took out one of the masts of the ship. And because John and Charles are mere mortals like you and I, they began to fret. But they noted something, that the Moravians on the boat were supernaturally calm. They had this weird peace. Moreover, they were singing hymns in the midst of the storm. Something like Paul and Silas, when in Acts 16 they were imprisoned in that jail in Philippi, and instead of weeping because they had been beaten and their hands and feet were in shackles, it says they were singing praises to the Lord. So too these Moravians on this damaged boat. And John and Charles were convicted, and they thought, we don't have the peace these Moravians have. Maybe the holiness that we think we have attained through this method, maybe we haven't really found it. In fact, it so struck them that after about a year of ministry in Savannah, Georgia, John fell into almost a malaise, a type of depression, because he could not help but think, am I real? What's happened to me? Eventually, about after a year of ministry, he comes back to London, and he comes upon this little Moravian meeting house on a famed street in London called Aldersgate. And in this little meeting house, history records that John Wesley, filled with this sense of despair, filled with this sense of, why don't I have the peace these Moravians have, filled with a desire to be holy unto the Lord, in this meeting house, it says John Wesley was converted. Let me read to you his firsthand account of what happened in this little meeting house on a little street in London in the year 1738. He says, in the evening, I went unwillingly to a society on Aldersgate Street, and there was somebody reading Martin Luther's preface to the book of Romans, which, by the way, you can read this in my library up here at the church. It's a magnificent preface Martin Luther wrote some 500 years ago to Paul's letter. evidently that little preface, which I have in my library, was being read out loud a couple hundred years ago in the hearing of John Wesley. And upon hearing it, it says about a quarter before nine, while he was describing the change which God works in the heart through faith in Christ, some of the most famous words John Wesley ever wrote. He said, "I felt my heart strangely warmed," which is a most poetic description, is it not, of what happened to each of you when Christ saved you. You may have not used those words, but you recall there was a moment where it's like the light came on, the scales fell off. There was a change, as it were, within. John Wesley, having been this studious man raised in a Christian home who did more spiritual disciplines in his few years of college than most of us have cumulatively done in our lives, nevertheless, it wasn't until this moment on Aldersgate when he says his heart was strangely warmed, and I did trust in Christ. Christ alone for salvation. And I was given assurance that he had taken away my sins, even mine, and he saved me from the law of sin and death. John Wesley reported in that moment that God supernaturally, sovereignly came like a lightning bolt and saved him. It's as if his heart in that moment was strangely warmed. And his brother Charles, you may say coincidentally or providentially, experienced a similar phenomenon 3 days earlier. John and Charles were saved. And in that moment, this conversion, which is one of the most famous things that happened in their life, in this little meeting house on Aldersgate, upon their conversion, they began to do three things that have marked Methodism to this day. The first thing was John began to do something innovative. He picked this up from his fellow Methodist buddy, George Whitfield. He began to, instead of be the stately London preacher, which, by the way, in that day, all the London preachers were kind of that typical stiff upper lip. They'd come in, they'd give their little homily, they'd go and just be real respectful. It's kind of like what you would expect from a Brit. They're not going to do anything too crazy. Well, John decided to start doing what's called open-air preaching, which at the time had never really been seen before. He started to go out on horseback, and he would just preach out, well, in the open, not in a church house. And as he began to do this, it began to have an amazing influence. It is reported that John Wesley rode on a horseback 20,000 miles a year. Is that not insane? Can you imagine going 20,000 miles a year on horseback? It's reported that he would preach some 800 sermons a year. By comparison, if Clint preached every Sunday here, and he'll probably only preaches about 46 Sundays a year, that's 46 sermons. And then if you double it with the Wednesday nights, let's round up to 100. That's 1/8 of what John Wesley was doing in a given year. Riding 20,000 miles on horseback, preaching 800 sermons a year. Typically, at a day, he'd wake up at 4 a.m., he'd preach at 5 a.m. I don't know what poor souls were listening to him at 5 a.m., but he evidently did it often. And then he would get on the road for his next preaching assignment at 6 a.m. This guy was after it. John Wesley began this open, itinerant ministry of preaching on horseback. Another thing that this conversion influenced was his brother Charles. Charles is most remembered to this day for being one of the most famous hymn writers in history. I gave you a few. Let me give you a few more to see if you recall any of these famed hymns. You ever heard the hymn, "Oh, for a Thousand Tongues to Sing"? That was Charles Wesley's. I've already mentioned "Hark the Herald Angels Sing" and "Christ the Lord is Risen Today." Are you familiar with "Come Thou Long Expected Jesus"? Famed hymn written by Charles. Or "And Can It Be?" That's a wonderful hymn written by him. I love that hymn. Or "Arise, My Soul, Arise." Some of his most famous. He wrote some 6,500 hymns. That is a lot of output, evidently, that this brother put out. It inspired Charles' hymn writing. And then lastly, one of the unique innovations of the Methodist Church is prior to this time, do you want to know what really didn't exist in Christianity on any large scale? Small groups. You know, Sunday school as a phenomenon really didn't even come about till the 1800s. And a predecessor to Sunday school was the Methodist practice of small groups. Methodists are actually renowned for their small group methodology. Charles began to do something that George Whitefield was not doing. Raise your hand if you're familiar or heard the name George Whitefield. George Whitefield is probably the most famous preacher in American history, maybe other than Billy Graham. He is renowned as one of the most gifted orators of all time. In fact, he was such a gifted orator that one of the most famous atheists in American history, or you could call him a deist, but he really didn't believe, Benjamin Franklin knew George Whitefield. And Benjamin Franklin loved George Whitefield, but didn't believe a word he said, but he loved listening to him. It is reported that George Whitefield was so eloquent that he could make a grown man cry just by pronouncing the word Mesopotamia. That's literally written in history books, that people remarked that he could just move a crowd with his theatrics. George Whitefield and John Wesley were a tandem group, but there was a difference. George Whitefield, a lot like Billy Graham, was your wide-scale evangelist. Ben Franklin one time went to listen to him preach and wanted to see how loud he was. So he started backpedaling. And I forget how far back he backpedaled, but he backpedaled hundreds of yards until he could not hear him. I think he had made it like a quarter of a mile before he stopped hearing his voice. And then he did some math, and he estimated that the circumference of that space could have held 30,000 people that could have heard him speaking in a day where there was no amplification, no microphone. George Whitefield was one speaker. But like Billy Graham, he'd come into town, do a great mass evangelism campaign. The Spirit would move. People would come to Christ. But then he moved on to other towns. That was his ministry. I'm not criticizing him. He was an evangelist. What differentiated George Whitefield from John Wesley is John Wesley did one additional step. He took seriously the after effect. Now what do we do with people that are converted? We need to start figuring out a method of discipleship for them. So he began this small group ministry where he would get all these men and women into smaller groups where they could continue to grow in grace from the time of their conversion. That was a distinct mark of Methodism. Now, what happens to Methodism? How did it get here to the United States? It spreads on over, principally through George Whitefield. George Whitefield is known as one who came into colonial America, and his gospel ministry spread like wildfire. In fact, Benjamin Franklin reports that in Philadelphia, where he lived, that once George Whitefield came into town, after he left, Benjamin Franklin observed a remarkable difference in the city. Let me read to you something Benjamin Franklin penned. He said, "A change was soon made in the manner of all the inhabitants of the city. From being thoughtless or indifferent about religion, it seemed as if all the world was growing religious, so that you really couldn't even walk through the town in the evening without hearing psalms being sung in different families of every street." He noticed that George Whitefield's Methodist ministry was having a profound impact on colonial America. So you see it begin to spread throughout the colonies. Now, here's the trick. Methodism, as we know it, actually did not exist yet. Do you remember what I said a few minutes ago? John Wesley and George Whitefield, they were not Methodist preachers. What were they? They were Church of England preachers. They were Anglicans. They were coming into the United States basically preaching a revivalistic form of Anglicanism. They disagreed with stuff, but they were essentially self-identifying as Anglicanism. So the question then becomes, what happened? What happened? What drove the Church of England out of America in the late 1700s? Any of you history whizzes in the room know what would have made England a bit of a faux pas in the late 1700s in the United States? Well, they had this little issue called the American Revolutionary War. And here's what happened during the war in the 1700s. Church of England is a little too associated with the King of England, and they had a problem. John Wesley needed to ordain some new bishops, some new leaders in the church. But guess who stiff-armed him? The Church of England, because they didn't like all these rebellious colonists over here. And so John Wesley decided, well, you know what? I'm going to ordain them whether you like it or not. And in so doing, he essentially made up his whole new denomination in that moment. The second he decided to disobey the bishops of the Church of England across the sea, he had begun, in essence, his own denomination. He began what we know to this day as the Methodist movement as a denomination by deciding to do what he wanted despite the bishops in England saying, no thank you, because we were in war. And so the first group you really see form in the United States, it's a name you've probably never heard of, I would guess. The original Methodist church was actually called the Methodist Episcopal Church. Episcopal is with reference to the hierarchy, the bishops and the priests and this whole little tiered hierarchy. The Methodist Episcopal Church was basically a more Methodist version of the Anglican Church. That's how it started. And it started with two men, two significant names you should mark down, Thomas Coke and Francis Asbury. Some of you may be familiar with the website cokesbury.com. That's basically the Methodist Lifeway. You go to that website, you get all the books you need from there. That was derived from the name Thomas Coke. You may be familiar in history with a college rooted in Maryland, Baltimore area called Cokesbury College. It's defunct. It has been for a couple centuries, I think. But it started as a Methodist school. You've already heard me name Asbury College and Seminary, where the revival broke out last February. That is a homage to Francis Asbury, one of these men that helped found Methodism here in the United States. So you might be wondering, well, Pastor, all right, I've never heard of the Methodist Episcopal Church, but I have heard of other types. I see these things called UMC, United Methodist Churches, everywhere. What's that? Or I keep hearing about this thing called the Wesleyan Church. What's that? Or have you ever seen those AME Zion churches? Or AME, without the word Zion, AME, African Methodist Episcopal Churches? What do you do with these? Where did all these groups come from? Well, as is so often the case, the Methodist denomination began to splinter over differences. Man, it happens. The Methodist Episcopal Church first started to split over disagreements on church government. For example, there was some that thought it should be very hierarchical and completely dependent on one another. But there was another group that thought, no, I think we need to have more independence. We don't need to be as subservient to all these leaders outside of our church. So you started to see a split. For example, you have the United Methodist Church, UMC, which is the largest Methodist denomination today. There are many all over the country that originally split off in the 1800s. They actually had a different name at first. The United Methodist name wasn't adopted until 1968, I believe, or so. But it broke off basically disagreeing on how they should organize the church. The Wesleyan Church as a denomination, sometimes they're called the Wesleyan Methodist Church, it also split off basically disagreeing over how to organize the church government. But perhaps the more decisive issue, which actually influenced those two groups splitting off too, it was slavery. Slavery, as was the case in the Presbyterian Church, as was the case in the Baptist denomination, it was also a contentious issue within the Methodist Church. No surprise, because slavery was the contentious issue of the century in the 1800s. And some might argue it's persisted to this very day. In the Methodist Church, you started to see a group of African American Methodists split off because they realized that the degree to which racism was still within the fabric of the culture of the 1800s, that they were never going to be able to worship freely unless they separated on their own. And so they began what was called the African Methodist Episcopal Church, AME. Now, some of you may be familiar with another name, AME Zion, African Methodist Episcopal Zion. Interestingly, the AME Zion Church, guess where it's headquartered? Here in Charlotte. It's actually just south of my house. If you go down Sugar Creek Road past Harris Boulevard, in between Harris Boulevard and kind of like the Mallard Creek, Graham Street interchange, it's kind of a back road of sorts. Their international headquarters is there on that street. The AME Zion is basically just another flavor of the AME Church. It didn't split off from the AME Church. They just both kind of formed at the same time, and one took the AME Zion name because of the history of the word Zion with reference to our heavenly abode that is to come. So you had those denominations split off largely over slavery, which, by the way, you could rightly argue that the United Methodist Church split over this very issue. It wasn't just over church government, it was also over slavery. And then lastly, perhaps the most famous and contemporary issue is over LGBTQ issues. Now, the truth of the matter is this would not have been a subject in most churches 30 years ago. it's become an issue. That's not to suggest it's a new issue, but really the LGBT agenda did not really hit the American culture with ferocity until Vice President Joe Biden in 2010 basically spoke in favor of it. And then in 2012 when President Barack Obama tipped his hat towards it, and then in 2015 when it was legalized, so-called, by the U.S. Supreme Court. In so doing, it has caused waves in almost every denomination, because many denominations, Baptists are not excluded from this, have two wings. There's a wing that is so-called liberal, and that, while it also happens to parallel with politics, theological liberalism means you question the Bible a lot. Theological conservatism means you don't question the Bible. You take it at its word. Well, in the Methodist Church, as is the case in almost every other denomination, there was infighting. There was a wing of the United Methodist Church that said, we should affirm LGBTQ people and we should ordain celibate gay people. So basically, as long as you're not like living in that sort of non-celibate, I mean, they're basically saying, if you're openly living a gay lifestyle, it's okay, we should be able to ordain you. There was a wing. Well, there was, no surprise, another wing of the United Methodist Church that said, this, we can't stand for this, and it's not rooted in hatred, it's rooted out of fear of God. This is not what the Bible teaches. And do you guys realize that this split occurred just a few months ago? We are living in history right now. The United Methodist Church just experienced the largest denominational split in the history of American Christianity. Notice I didn't say in the history of Methodist Christianity. In all U.S. Christian history, there has never been a larger denominational split than what occurred in December of 2023. It began in 2020 when they brought this to a conference debate. And it began to roil until at last there was a group that realized this is irreconcilable. We're not going to be able to agree to disagree on this. We're going to have to split. And so it's reported that some 7,660 churches within the United Methodist Church split. They left it and they have formed what's called the Global Methodist Church, which is now a new denomination, which I think it doesn't have all 6,600 of them. I think it has like 3,000 to 4,000 of them at this point anyway. And it's considered the new conservative wing of the United Methodist Church, which means, as a gross generalization, the United Methodist Church, as it stands to this day, is a liberal denomination. That's not to suggest that there aren't any churches that have stayed within the UMC that are like hanging on for dear life, but they don't agree. They may disagree with that. I'm not suggesting, I don't know the hearts of all these churches, but officially, the United Methodist Church might as well be a mainline Protestant church, which y'all remember what I said about mainline Protestantism? It's not really Christianity. This is when you are denying some of the central core tenets of the Bible, you are on a fast track to being something other than the faith once for all delivered to the saints. Now, I recognize that is a most strong statement, and I have no grounds to actually make that, because I'm not a scholar of the United Methodist Church, and B, I don't know a lot of these pastors. What I do know is that the official theological lines that have been drawn, the United Methodist Church, as it stands today anyway, has taken a stand questioning the biblical ethic on human sexuality. And if you actually investigate, you'll discover that the lion's share of those churches that have taken that stand, this isn't the first thing that they've let drop. They have been questioning the Bible and its inerrancy for decades. You're going to discover that the hermeneutic that allows you to say God is cool with homosexuality when the Bible is so painfully explicit, it's honestly, you go watch some of the YouTube videos of these so-called scholars trying to tell you the Bible says the opposite of what it says. It's kind of maddening, because I'm thinking, do you think we're dummies? Like, it's painfully apparent. The hermeneutic that allows you to jump there is the same hermeneutic that allows you to basically change almost any text you want to say whatever you want. So there's the most recent split within the Methodist Church. The UMC has split largely from the Global Methodist Church. Now, don't go home and tell your friends, my pastor said all the United Methodists are liberals. I don't know that. I just know that the official line the UMC has taken to this day is a theologically liberal line. So do with that as you will, and if I'm wrong, send me an email. Okay, Let's turn the page now, and let's just conclude our study tonight by looking at a couple things. What do they believe, and what's distinctive about them? Let me just very briefly highlight some of these, because these aren't really critical things to discuss. Methodists, as a generalization, are wholly orthodox. They're evangelical. Most of their beliefs you're going to probably hear taught in your own Sunday school class. So they're a Christian denomination. This is a group that you're not really going to see a whole lot of differentiation between them and perhaps your Baptist Sunday school you would go to. They do have a few source documents that kind of drive their theology. A lot of Methodists may not even be painfully aware of these, but these are sources that really have kind of determined the doctrinal trajectory of the denomination. You'll notice all four of them have association with one man, the guy who founded it, John Wesley. On the one hand, John Wesley published this thing called Doctrinal Minutes, which was basically just a paper that had all of his doctrinal positions. It was a synthesis of all these beliefs he had the Bible taught, like how God justifies you, sanctifies you, what the church is like, etc. They looked to that document. John Wesley has some 138 sermons out there that are considered heavily influential to the Methodist Church that they use to kind of discern his interpretation on this, that, or the other. During 1755, John Wesley became pretty ill, evidently, and while he was recuperating, he had a lot of downtime, so he wrote a commentary on the Bible. It's called John Wesley's, or on the New Testament, and it's called his Explanatory Notes on the New Testament. It's basically kind of like the study Bible running commentary. And then lastly, John Wesley took the Church of England's Articles of Faith, they have 39 of them, and he basically kind of edited them into his own. He took the 39 Articles of Faith, but he eliminated 14 of them, and he revised upwards of 25 of them into this Articles of Faith that kind of represented his view of how the church should be organized and some of his doctrinal distinctives. And those have been documents that have been heavily depended upon by Methodist pastors and scholars to this very day. Now let's get to what's interesting. That's just kind of out there. Let's get to the meat of it now, and we'll conclude our study with this. What does distinguish the Methodists? As a generalization, and not all Methodists are agree on all this, but as a generalization, what are some of those core distinctives? Well, I have four that I've listed out, but you could have listed 14. Let me just give you these four for the purposes of tonight. The first one I want you to note is a core distinctive of Methodism is how they govern themselves. Now, you may remember, what was distinctive about the way Baptists govern themselves? Anybody remember the word we used to describe their form of church government, our form of church government? It's called congregationalism. Congregationalism is the view that every church is independent, autonomous, and ruled by the congregation. So guess what? When the day comes for Clint Presley to retire, there will not be somebody in Nashville at the Baptist headquarters that will say, we're sending you this guy as your new pastor. Do you want to know who will get to choose your new pastor? You guys, the congregation. That's how the organization works. There will be a collective vote to determine who's the next pastor. That's, for example, congregationalism. Opposed to congregationalism is a different type of church government, typified by the Presbyterians. That's actually where they get their name. We taught this last 2 weeks ago. The Presbyterians, they believe in what's called a, well, Presbyterian government. And a Presbyterian government, from the Greek word presbyteros, which means elder, they think that the church shouldn't be run by the congregation, but should be run by a group of appointed elders. And they get this because actually the New Testament does talk about this at length, about these elders being appointed in all the churches of the region. And so they'll say the congregation should elect a representative group of godly men who can devote their time to leading and making most of the big decisions of the church. The elder model, the Presbyterian model of church government. Now, there's another model of church government that was exemplified by the Church of England and, to a degree, by the Catholic Church. That's called the Episcopal government, which is very hierarchical. You've got an archbishop who oversees a bunch of bishops, who oversee a bunch of priests, who oversee a bunch of deacons, for et cetera. It's this kind of tiered approach, maybe the way you would organize your business, the military. Well, the Methodist Church, what did they come out of? They didn't come out of the Presbyterians. They didn't come out of the Baptists. What did they come out of? The Episcopal, the Anglican Church. So they adopted this sort of Episcopal type of government, but they liked some of the stuff they saw in the congregational side. They liked the autonomy these churches had. So they had this sort of, this is my spin on it, it's almost like this happy medium they tried to create between an Episcopal form of government and a congregational form of government. They generally call it connectionalism. It's a weird word, you maybe never heard it before. Some Methodist church actually call themselves a Methodist connection with an X, connection, that X is that C-T-I-O-N that we would normally spell it as. It's an archaic way they would have spelled it in Great Britain many years ago. Sometimes they'll use that phraseology, and that is essentially a reference to they govern themselves by, they have leaders outside of them. So for example, it's not uncommon for pastors to move within the Methodist church. If you have any background with Methodist church, you may have wondered, sometimes like the pastors, they'll last 5 to 10 years maybe, then they're getting moved on, and they don't even have that much of a choice. I'm not saying they're like slaves, but they're being told, you really need to go to this next group, and they end up kind of shuffling around. That's the sort of polity they have, where they're all connected together, but the churches are all kind of individual, but then there's this accountability that comes with all the other pastors kind of being shell-gamed around. And there's a bunch of reasons why they do that, but that's just one facet of the Methodist church that separates itself from the Baptist church. Another thing that differentiates them is what they believe about how God saves. So, for example, you may recall last week, we discussed that one distinct feature of the Presbyterian Church is their view of how God saves. If there was two teams to put against each other on this debate, it would be the Presbyterians and the Methodists. You know, the Baptists are pretty split on this, by the way. Baptists fall on both sides of this issue, including Southern Baptists. The Presbyterians are almost exclusively in this one camp, often called a Reformed camp or a Calvinistic camp, whereas the Methodists are almost exclusively in this other camp, often called an Arminian camp or a Wesleyan camp. Let me just differentiate the two so that we can have a general idea of the debate. Their view would be contrary to the Presbyterians. They would say, all right, when we read the Bible, we disagree with you Presbyterians on how you think God saves people. We believe that, yes, man is depraved. Man has a sin nature. But unlike you Presbyterians that teach that man is enslaved to sin such that he would never willfully choose God unless God broke in on his life, we believe that God has shed, they call it prevenient grace. It's actually not a biblical word. It's actually not even that clearly in the Bible, but it's a core conviction of theirs that there's this grace that comes before, prevenient. That's what the word means. This grace that comes before that enables dead sinners to choose God. So a core conviction is, yes, we are dead in sin, but we've been given a grace from Jesus on the cross that enables us to accept or reject him. They also would say, okay, you Presbyterians, you teach that God unconditionally elects people. And we're going to argue that when the Bible uses the word predestination or election, what we think it means is he predestines you according to foreknowledge. So he knew that you would choose this, and so he chose you knowing you would. Which is a kind of a philosophical deal that kind of make your head spin. But they're going to satisfy logic by saying, he only elects based off knowing that you would elect him, essentially. So they would call it conditional election rather than unconditional election. They would also say, you Presbyterians think that when Jesus died on the cross, he died for his own. His blood did something. It was shed for real people. There was a limit to his atonement. His atonement only atoned people who believed in him. We would say, no, his blood was shed for everybody, which, by the way, a Presbyterian and a Calvinistic Baptist would say the same thing. They would say anybody can be saved, but they would argue that the blood was shed for anybody. There was an unlimited nature to the atonement, and some people receive it, and some people, you know, they wouldn't use this word, but basically just kind of like throw it away. They would also say, you Presbyterians say that God's grace is irresistible, that if God is going to save you, he is going to make it happen, that one way or another, you are not going to resist that grace, that God, if he is drawing you, you will come to him, that nobody's going to escape his grip. They'll say, no, you can resist grace. Experience tells me that I can resist it, that I don't think you're being faithful to the Bible. And then lastly, as a generalization, the Arminian Wesleyan view would say, you Calvinists or you Presbyterians, you believe that when God saves you, you're once saved and you're always going to be saved and you're never going to escape God's hand. they would say, no, I don't think you're going to actually, I think you can actually lose your salvation. I think it's actually very easy to do that. So they wouldn't teach once saved, always saved. Now, some of you Baptists in here are thinking, well, man, I'm confused now because I agree with some over here and I agree with some over here. Welcome to being a Baptist. Baptists are a little bit split on this issue. That's why I didn't put up Baptists versus Methodists. I put up Presbyterians versus Methodists. Baptists often live in a hybrid world. You know, Baptists, Southern Baptists in particular, they originated as Calvinistic. It wasn't until the mid-20th century that they even became more generally revivalistic and Arminian. Presbyterians have been from the very beginning. Methodists have been pretty Wesleyan, Arminian. Well, no duh, they're Wesleyan. They came from John Wesley. They've been Wesleyan pretty much from the very beginning. So that's a second core distinction. They would differentiate not only on how you govern, but they would differentiate on how God saves. Now, here's the most distinctive aspect of Wesleyanism, of Methodism. I wonder how many of you are familiar with this. They have a most unusual view on how God sanctifies. Now, let's remind ourselves, what does it mean that God sanctifies us? The Bible teaches that when God saves us, that means he declares sinners righteous. We use the big theological word justification. It's like he bangs the gavel and says, Kyler, you're a wicked sinner, but I'm declaring you innocent in my eyes because of what Jesus did for you. I'm saved. Now, what happens next? Folks, am I allowed to live however I want until the day I die because I got fire insurance? No, we know that. You Baptists, you folks at Hickory Grove, Clint and I have preached to you a trillion times that when God saves you, he changes you. And if you are not experiencing a change, that's actually proof positive that you were never saved. Your fruit is not what saves you. Your fruit is just what tells me there's actually a root where you were saved. It's the evidence that something had already happened to you. Well, in the Methodist Church, they would say, contrary to the average Baptist or Presbyterian or many denominations, the Methodist Church would say, okay, when God saves you, yes, he changes you, but we think he can and often will change you way more than most of you think. So, for example, Baptists recognize, and many other denominations, that yes, when God saves you, he changes you, but for most of us, it's painfully slow. Some of us slower than others. We're slowly being made into God's image, and none of us believe that we will be made perfectly into God's image until we are glorified one day in heaven, that we will be struggling with sin till the day we die. What's really interesting in the Methodist Church is that one thing they teach is that they believe you can actually be entirely sanctified in this life. Some call this Christian perfectionism. Here's where it's coming from, and I want to be fair to them and say what it actually means and what it doesn't mean, because I don't want to create a caricature here. They believe that this side of eternity, God can change you enough where you can become perfect. And they say this because they read verses in the Bible like, you must be perfect as God is perfect. And they say, okay, well, Jesus said that in Matthew 5, that must mean it's possible. What does it mean to be perfect? Well, they would argue that you can attain a level of perfection this side of eternity. And here's what they don't mean, and here's what they do mean. They don't mean that that means you'll be free from any ignorance, that you're going to know everything perfectly. Obviously, they don't believe you're going to be omniscient. They also don't think it means you'll be free from mistakes. They recognize that people mess up. We're sinners. We're human. To err is human, as the philosophers would say. They don't mean you're going to be free from infirmities, that that means you'd be free of disabilities or any sickness or ailments. They would say that's a part of living in a fallen world. They also would not say that perfection would be you'll be free from temptation. Jesus himself was tempted. They'd say you will have temptations too. What they do mean by this is you can be completely freed from slavery to sin, which, I mean, I would say, yes, we are freed from slavery to sin. So I'm going to agree with that statement. And from any and all evil thoughts and attitudes and inclinations. And so really what they're arguing is, in essence, there is a promise, they would argue in the Bible, that you can be so sanctified that you can live, dare we say, in a state of Christian perfection, wherein you are not battling sin to the degree a great many others will. which I've just, that has not been my experience. I challenge anybody who claims that and really interrogate what they precisely mean by that. I really would struggle. I mean, guys, I don't know about you, but the longer I walk with the Lord, the more I see myself to be a sinner, not less. I don't feel more holy today than 20 years ago. I actually feel less holy, which is actually a sign of God's grace in me. I see God as more holy and me as less holy. And whenever that day comes where I limp across the finish line and, Lord willing, fall into His arms, I'll throw everything at His feet and say, man, if you let me in, it is all of grace, all of grace, all of grace. And I think that's really the cry of most sinners. And I'm not suggesting that Methodists who believe in this wouldn't ultimately say the same thing. I don't know. But this is a core conviction. In fact, John Wesley said that he believes this very doctrine is the great deposit. He called it the great depositum, the greatest contribution Methodism made to Christianity was restoring this conviction that you could be entirely sanctified. It actually spurned a movement called the Holiness Movement. You guys might be familiar with a lot of church groups associated with the Holiness Movement. You ever heard of the Church of the Nazarene? I'm from Oklahoma City. There's a big Church of the Nazarene headquarters there. You familiar with the Salvation Army? It has its roots in this holiness movement. The United Methodist Church and the Wesleyan Church really are a part of this holiness movement. It's all from this core distinctive of how God sanctifies. And then let me just give you one fourth and final one. Some of you may have heard about how the baptismal practices of the Methodist Church differ from the Baptists, and you may be wondering what's going on there. You've heard they baptize babies. So you're thinking, well, do they just share the same conviction as the Presbyterians? Remember last week we learned that the Presbyterians baptize babies because they see baptism as basically the New Testament version of circumcision. It's not quite what the Methodist Church views it as. Here's where the Methodist Church is different. The Methodist Church would call baptism not an ordinance. We call it an ordinance, which is another word for something Jesus ordained we keep doing till He comes back. They don't call it an ordinance. They call it a sacrament, which is not unique to them. Lots of people use that word. Sacrament infers that there's a special grace that's bestowed. God actually gives you a unique grace when you get baptized. And so they'll baptize anybody at any age. They would recommend that if you are a Christian and you have a child, you should baptize that child because it's going to give that child a special grace as you raise them in the fear of the Lord. They would not say you should baptize the child of an unbelieving couple, because they would say that that child is not within a covenant family. But if you are raised in a Christian family, you should get baptized. If you profess faith later in life, you should get baptized then too. But you shouldn't get rebaptized. They're not into just like redunking. And also, by the way, they don't just dunk. The Methodists, I almost said Catholic because it's similar, they will do different modes. Remember, Baptists believe in immersion. You got to go under the water. Well, they'll believe in effusion or sprinkling, where they'll just sprinkle the water or pour it on your head. So you may have noticed those as a unique differentiation within the Methodist Church. Full circle, let's put a punctuation mark at the end of it. The Methodist Church, as a gross generalization, is a thoroughly evangelical denomination. Most Methodists you'll meet would believe that we are saved by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone. Methodism mirrors to a great extent the average evangelical Baptist. There are some theological differences here and there. There are unfortunately prominent streams of Methodism to this day, principally within the United Methodist Fellowship, that are distinctly theologically liberal. And by that I mean they are denying the Bible. The hot button issue right now is LGBTQ issues, but that is just a symptom of a much bigger disease therein. So you need to be aware of that. But there are a lot of really liberal Baptists. I've already told you one of the most liberal churches in Charlotte is the beautiful Myers Park Baptist Church down in Dilworth. Most beautiful church you'd ever see, and it's got Baptists on it, and they don't believe one thing we believe. So that is not a unique problem to the Methodist Church. It's not unique. The Presbyterians have a bunch of liberal churches in it as well. You're going to see these divides wholesale. Next week, though, I hope you come back, because we're going to look at what might be the most fascinating of the five denominations groups we're going to look at. We're going to look at that big, giant, confusing conglomeration of Christians, many of which are prominently shown on television through prosperity preachers, called the Pentecostals. What do you do with the Pentecostal movement? Where did they come from? And how do you make sense of them all? That'll be our study next Wednesday night. Why don't you join me as we pray? We'll call it a night. I hope to see you next week. Let's pray. Father in heaven, I'm asking that you would go with these brothers and sisters. I pray tomorrow morning they'd wake up and be convicted to be in your word. One thing we ought to learn from fellow brothers in Christ like John and Charles Wesley is we ought to take holiness seriously. We ought to take spiritual discipline seriously. We ought to fear you. So I pray tomorrow that you would convict us to hear you as you speak to us in your word and in turn speak to you in prayer. Would you go before these dear brothers and sisters, I pray. And would you gather them back again this coming Sunday, next Wednesday night, as we continue to study you for the glory of your name and the good of the gospel witness of this church. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Good night, everybody. We'll see you Sunday.